Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby from Bennington, Vermont. 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is former Environmental Conservation Commissioner for the state of New York and former president of the National Audubon Society, Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, the moratorium on listing endangered species is over and the Fish and Wildlife Service tries to begin again. Meanwhile, in California, a collaborative effort may be the future of how we protect endangered species. The political engine is revved up over the repeal of the gasoline tax, but what will it mean for the environment? We'll look at what past climate change might tell us about our future. And the Earth calendar is itchy. Poison ivy season is upon us. These stories and more coming up this week on The Environment Show. We continue our examination of the effect the federal budget impasse had on our environment and natural resources. The good news is that in the process of adopting the budget, the moratorium on listing under the Federal Endangered Species Act has now been lifted. Previously, the Congress had specified that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service was prohibited from listing any more species, regardless of whether they were about to go extinct. Molly Beatty, director of the Fish and Wildlife Service, says protection of endangered species is important because the creatures are canaries in the coal mine that share the same ecosystem and fate that we do.
It's not just a effort by pointy-headed biologists to save slimy creatures with funny names. This program and this law really have a tremendous effect on the economic and physical welfare of people.
Beatty says they cannot tell what impact the moratorium has had.
We do not and would not yet know if any species had been lost or turned into emergencies during the year, simply because we were basically instructed by Congress not to spend any money or effort on this program. And therefore, tracking species was not a possibility. So when you say, well, were there any emergencies or were there any extinctions, we really don't know yet. We had taken all the people that did this work and moved them into other jobs. And now we're in the process of bringing them back. So it's, again, it's just like the government furlough. You have to pick up the whole machine and put its wheels back on and put some gas in it and try to get it started again.
Beatty's current task is getting the people in place to start sorting out the 243 species whose listing was proposed when the moratorium went into effect, and the 182 candidate species that were at an earlier stage of analysis.
It just leaves us bewildered about what the purpose of this was, because it didn't gain us anything for the environment. It didn't gain us anything for the critters. It cost us a lot of money we could be spending on conservation to restart the program. It didn't add or take away anything from the Endangered Species Act itself. So it just sort of left us all sitting here kind of in the rubble trying to put it back together again, thinking, well, what was that all about?
Molly Beatty is the director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. I'm Peter Burley, and you're listening to The Environment Show. Reach us by email at envshow@aol.com. That's envshow@aol.com. Several years ago, a small gray bird known as the California gnatcatcher, which inhabits coastal sage scrub habitat in Southern California, was listed by the Fish and Wildlife Service as a threatened species under the Endangered Species Act. To protect the bird, development would have to be curtailed in California's Orange and San Diego counties. The ensuing controversy over the gnatcatcher has led to a whole new way of thinking about endangered species.
That listing has provided the backbone for a series of multiple species plans that seek to protect not only the gnatcatcher but many other species as well. What people realized was that once they were taking the time and money to protect the gnatcatcher and coastal sage scrub, it was cost-effective and efficient to go on and try to do a more comprehensive approach. And we've supported that because we feel that these comprehensive plans are really our best hope for tying together the remaining fragments of habitat which exist in this very depleted and highly developed part of the country, which is coastal Southern California.
Those were the views of Dan Silver, coordinator for the Endangered Habitats League, a coalition of California conservation groups. This ecosystem approach involves getting property owners, developers and environmentalists, local, state and federal government officials all to agree on a plan to protect a critical ecosystem. Doug Wheeler, the Secretary for Resources of the state of California, is trying to put together the plan and describes the process.
The indicator species, incidentally, which precipitated the controversy in California, which we are trying to resolve, is a small songbird, the California gnatcatcher. And what we've done simply is to bring the interested stakeholders, guided by good science. We've had the help of a scientific advisory panel together to plan areas of coastal sage scrub habitat, which once protected by action of local government, essentially, would assure, therefore, the protection of other associated species. And once we can develop such plans and they are presented for approval to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, we have a higher degree of certainty that the development processes in whatever form can proceed.
Wheeler would like to get habitat protection plans agreed to in all 10 bioregions in the state. He says that if communities do not agree on a plan, they're subject to imposition of single species plans by the federal government without their consent, and they forego help from both the state and the feds, which is available. The sage scrub bioregion plan calls for some public purchase of private land, and whether there is political will to raise the necessary money is still an open question, although the state plans to put up $6 million to start. While the reaction of landowners to this habitat protection approach varies, it's supported by Monica Florian, Senior Vice President for Corporate Affairs for the Irvine Company, which is the largest landowner in Orange County with thousands of acres. She says the single-species approach just didn't work.
On a project-by-project basis, one development at a time, or one species at a time, everyone would work very hard to come up with a solution, a mitigation, something that maybe changed the development and also provided for the species. That was a disruptive, costly process, but it didn't stop there because within a year or 2 years or maybe less or more time, another species might be listed and the whole process had to start all over again. And where we kept ending up, just really the economy and the industry overall, is with solutions that never quite caught on, and they didn't do the best that could be done for species, and they certainly were not helpful to local economies.
The unique thing about what happened in Orange County is that everybody participated simultaneously. In San Diego County, with many smaller landowners, agreement has been harder to achieve. County Supervisor Bill Horn, who has been raising avocados in the county for 26 years, feels the plan being discussed there is unfair to people holding open land and agriculturalists.
We see part of the unincorporated area of the county and dealing with the city of San Diego and some of the cities, we see part of this habitat plan as a plan they devised to use our land for open space so they could develop their cities more and increase their densities. That number one, is not fair. Number two, we think it's wrong for them to push ag out and put overlays on us and not pay us for the land, and yet at the same time, they're doing just the opposite of what they're claiming they're doing is they're increasing their densities, they're increasing their opportunities to develop, they're making the city bigger, and yet at the same time they're destroying the quality of life in the unincorporated area of the county.
Despite the difficulties, the cooperative planning process going on in California to protect large blocks of habitat for multiple species appears to be a way to protect more land, more species, more effectively and with less friction than the single-species approach that has dominated implementation of the Endangered Species Act in the past. While every part of the country is unique, cooperative agreements which bring into play the land-use planning powers of local and state governments offer real hope, both for species which might otherwise disappear and for the American landscape they depend on. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, politicians are revved up over the repeal of the gas tax, but what does this mean for the environment? We'll look at what climate change throughout history might tell us about the future. And our Earth calendar is itchy as poison ivy season begins. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. Some economists and environmentalists have long argued that the price of gasoline should be substantially higher to promote better conservation and a cleaner environment. Since lowering the gas tax is now a feature of the presidential campaign, we wanted to have an Environment Show debate on the gas tax and its environmental impact. The American Petroleum Institute, which represents the oil industry, said this was a fight they did not want to get involved in. And the Dole campaign would not produce anyone by our deadline, so we present without edit or comment Carl Pope, executive director of the Sierra Club, responding to the question, from an environmentalist standpoint, is it a good idea to reduce the gas tax?
This is a really terrific idea if you like hurricanes, if you like spreading cholera and dengue fever into the United States, if you want to flood New York City, and if you like lots of flooding. It's a terrible idea otherwise. It's going to help destabilize global climate. It's not really going to put the American people on the road to driving fuel-efficient cars and using mass transit, which is what we need to do. There is, however, one saving grace. It's highly likely that reducing the gas tax will not have any environmental impact whatsoever because it won't reduce the price of gasoline. The oil companies will simply profit larger profits. So I think this is one of the less elegant exercises in public policy making we have seen from our government in some times.
Carl Pope is the executive director of the Sierra Club. Even before the budget was passed in Washington, the environment had emerged as a potent political issue. Both Republicans and Democrats appeared to be surprised by the extent of the public's outrage over threats to the nation's environmental laws. In a previous broadcast, we heard from a Democratic pollster who said Democrats had come out ahead and they would use the environment in the upcoming election season. Peter Snyder is with the Luntz Research Group, a Republican polling firm. He says the Republicans have been caught off guard.
Well, really, so far this year, the president, the Democrats, and Congress have been very successful in shaping the terms and issues of the political debate. They've been playing a great offense. The president has a mantra, the environment, education, Medicare, and Medicaid, that he repeats everywhere he goes in every interview. But then the Republicans have only been playing defense on these issues. So like it or not, they have to deal with the Democrats' issues and the president's issues in 96, and the environment's definitely going to be one of them.
With the landslide Republican victories in 1994, few people expected environmental protection would be a campaign issue. The Republicans are now working on how to hone their message on the environment. Schneider says they weren't used to being in the majority and having their ideas taken seriously.
What the Republicans have been at fault for doing is not communicating successfully on the environment. In the beginning, the Republicans in Congress were talking about rollbacks. They were talking about turning back the clock and going getting rid of regulation. The public really doesn't want that. They don't want to roll back anything. They don't want to go back to the days of dirty water and dirty air. They like what has been done with the environment, but what they do want is they want Washington to regulate smarter. And that's what the Republicans need to talk about.
Peter Snyder is with the Republican polling firm Luntz Research Company. Many expect both Republican and Democratic candidates to be assuming a green hue as Election Day nears. You're listening to The Environment Show. You can write us at 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. That's 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. We hope to hear from you. While scientists and politicians debate whether our climate is changing, research has come out recently that reveals what past climate change was like. It turns out that over the past many thousands of years, our climate has changed regularly, and often in dramatic fashion. Environment Show producer Thomas Lally reports.
By sampling rocks, ice, and even ancient pollen, scientists have been able to piece together what the Earth's climate was like as long as 150,000 years ago. What the picture reveals are patterns of cold and warm periods. Scientists have known for a long time that the climate changes periodically, but what they didn't know until recently is just how fast the change comes. Donald Rodbell is a geology professor at Union College in Schenectady, New York. He recently returned from the Andes Mountains in Peru, where he studied the ancient climate of the area, which had been preserved in the rocks. His research matches with climate information elsewhere in the world.
The speed of these natural climate changes are very, very much faster than we had thought even 5 years ago. Some of the ice core records from Greenland, which show annual layers of ice and different parameters, can be used to reconstruct temperatures over the ice cap over this time interval from about 15 to 8,000 years ago, show that the last warming from the end, at the end of the ice age may well have taken place on this time scale of decades rather than thousands of years as we thought even 5 or 10 years ago. So the speed with which these natural climate changes occurred is much faster than we anticipated. And the significance of that is that if, you know, now we're starting to run this giant experiment with our own climate as human beings, emitting enormous amounts of CO2 and methane and other greenhouse gases, the climatic effects of those emissions are going to be superimposed on natural climatic variations. And depending on what the natural cycles are, we could see some very, very abrupt climate change.
Climate change happens at least every 20,000 years or so because of changes in the Earth's orbit around the Sun. But other climate changes have occurred that cannot be explained by the orbital change. Scientists blame these shifts on large volcanic eruptions and changes in ocean current, but other causes remain a mystery. Rodbell says what is clear is that climate change in the past was global and sudden.
The globe may well not do a whole lot until some threshold level is passed, and beyond that threshold, the response may be very much non-linear, that is very, very abrupt and very large. I think the general consensus from the geologic record is that global climate has had a number of these very rapid and very abrupt shifts that are separated by not a whole lot of climate change going on, but the record is highly irregular and apparently responding in a very nonlinear fashion to fairly minor perturbations.
Now, so in other words, the ingredients that perhaps contributed to the climate change continued at a fairly constant rate, but the climate change occurred at a dramatic rate.
That's right. Yeah, it reached some threshold, and then a temperature took off or decreased, depending on which of these particular changes you're looking at. It seems that the climate warmings were fairly rapid. Whenever they occurred, they were very abrupt in response to a number of possibilities that were changing fairly slowly.
What this means for the future is unclear. Long-term trends in the climate are still not well understood, but what is clear is that the past has shown that the climate will change, perhaps suddenly and without warning. Professor Rodbell says by releasing greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide and methane into the atmosphere, we are risking enormous change in our climate. Donald Rodbell is a professor of geology at Union College in Schenectady, New York. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. We write the Earth Calendar to help connect you with some part of nature that's happening now. At this time of year, plants are lured above the ground by spring rain and sun. But among the green lurks a plant you do not want to connect with. Varieties of poison ivy, oak, and sumac grow all over North America and can wreak havoc for those allergic to them. Susan Carroll Hauser is author of Nature's Revenge, The Secrets of Poison Ivy, Poison Oak, Poison Sumac, and Their Remedies. She says all of these plants contain an oil called erucyol, which causes the allergic reaction. She says you'll have to go a long way to get away from any of these plants.
It's North American and East Asian. It apparently crossed the land bridge when there was one between Asia and North America. So poison ivy grows in Japan and China, Malaysia, and otherwise it's a North American phenomena for the moment. It grows in Canada. It doesn't like it too cold, so when you get to the tundra, it stops. It grows down into Mexico until it gets too tropical, then it stops. But the plant has been carried over to Europe as an ornamental, and also it was taken over to the dikes in Holland and used there as to hold the ground because it's such a good ground cover. And it has now escaped from the dike fronts in Holland and is growing in the Black Forest of Germany. So it may be a worldwide plant before long.
If you've ever had a case of poison ivy, you know how nasty it can be. Besides the itchy rash, severe cases include swelling and blisters which eventually burst and ooze out a yellow fluid. It's estimated that about 15% of people are immune to poison ivy, but the other 85% of us better watch out. Hauser says that when our body reacts to erucyol, it's actually making a mistake.
The immune system is not perfect. It's the same allergic reaction that people have to pollen, hay fever, or some people to strawberries or cucumbers. The body is pretty sophisticated and most of the time knows the difference between a bacteria and pollen. But once in a while, it gets aggressive in its immune response and goes after something that isn't dangerous, causing problems that are, in fact, sometimes dangerous.
Dealing with plants that contain erucyol can be tricky. You can't burn them since erucyol travels through smoke and treatments still leave sufferers with a rash for several days. Native Americans use jewelweed to treat reactions. But Hauser says the best treatment is to avoid contact in the first place. She says the old saying, leaves of three, let them be, is a good guide.
People say it must travel through the air because I didn't touch it, but I got it. But in fact, it cannot travel through the air, so they did not get it that way. Erucyol, however, remains active on objects for years. So if you step on some berries with your boot and put your boots away and take them out the next spring and put your hand on the bottom of the boot, you can get erucyol on your hand, you scratch your face, and you get poison ivy when you haven't been anywhere near a plant. So it's very important to understand how the erucyol works, and you must watch for objects that have touched it. The erucyol is still present in the stems, in the berries, in the roots. It is present in the plant after it is dead. So if you break sticks of poison ivy or poison oak or sumac branches, then you can get erucyol on yourself. Also, while erucyol cannot travel in air, it can travel in smoke. So it's very important to never burn poison ivy. Don't try to eradicate it by burning it. And if you're picking wood for a campfire, make sure you don't get any poison oak or ivy wood. The erucyol is carried in the smoke, and it gets in your ears, your eyes, and even your lungs. It gets on your clothing, so your clothing is covered with it. And it's a very big problem for forest firefighters. In fact, most of the research done on poison ivy has been in response to the problem with fighting forest fires.
Hauser says that if you come in contact with poison ivy, wash with rubbing alcohol, which neutralizes the erucyol. She keeps a mason jar and a washcloth in her car and around the house. Contrary to popular myth, laundry soap doesn't work. Actually, most of us just scratch. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For cassette copy, call 1-800-323-9262 and ask for program number 333. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Thomas Lally is the producer, and Dr. Alan Chartok is the executive producer. The Environment Show is made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby. 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.